guys, it's April 29th, 2018, and this is your episode 143 of At Percussion. I'm your host, Casey Cangelosi, and with me, as usual, are Megan Arms.
Hello.
And Laurel's out of town, and you're hearing our son Robin in the background. It's like percussion ensemble hit, finals hit, juries hit. She just split to Chicago, left me to do the podcast with Robin, so that's what you're hearing. Ben Charles is also here.
Hi, everybody.
Oh, man. It's getting noisy back there. So, hey, how's the semester wrapping up for everybody? Are you guys close to done? I'm basically done. I had juries today.
We wrap up on Wednesday, and this week was crazy. I didn't concert outside of school. I had 3 concerts in the school. So, yeah, but things are finally winding down. What do you mean, Megan?
Yeah, we've got one more week of classes and then finals week, and we do our juries the first day of finals week. So definitely starting to wind down. But sometimes it's harder this time of year. I feel like I do pretty good now of like making sure that percussion stuff is wrapped up right before that final week of band orchestra concerts and, you know, the craziness of all the finals and the academic classes. But yeah, I still like feel the intense stress from my students, you know, because it's really still super intense for them at the moment. But it's definitely wrapping up a little bit for me.
Very, very cool. Well, you guys, our guest today is an educator, a performer, and a composer. He's regularly commissioned and is just more and more active all the time, from at least my perspective. He's the assistant professor of percussion and jazz studies and coordinator of the percussion program at the University of Nebraska. And you can read more about him at dhallmusic.com. And he's Dave Hall. How's it going, Dave?
Great. Thanks so much for having me, guys. Good to be here.
Yeah, sure. And is your semester wrapping up, or do you still have some time?
Sort of. Our juries and barriers are technically on Wednesday this coming week. We had our last percussion ensemble concert last week, and right now I'm actually in Kirksville, Missouri, at Megan's old stomping grounds, Truman State.
Woo!
So
go Bulldogs.
I didn't even know what it was.
The color is purple, and the mascot is the Bulldog.
Is this Mike Bump?
Yes.
It is. Yep, absolutely. So he was really kind to have me out, and I'm here tomorrow doing clinics and lessons and doing a recital in the evening.
Little bed and breakfast?
Yeah, well, yeah, you can. I mean, no one can see us on the podcast, but you can look around. It's got sort of a...
Oh, you're there now.
Yeah, I'm there. I just got here.
I stayed there. I had a good time.
Hotel room.
Dave, you're also premiering. There's a new commission also on your recital.
Right. This is a consortium for an Adam Silverman piece. Uh-huh. I thought you were on that. Are you not on that?
I don't think I'm on it.
Anyway, yeah, it's a consortium organized by John Parks, as a lot of these pieces for Adams are. And this is, it's kind of like it's a multi-percussion drum set type setup with some kind of wild card instruments that you can select. It's really cool. It's called Downtown is the Battery. Tomorrow will be the first performance, will be the world premiere. So excited about it. It's really hip. It's got like, you can select the instruments. It's kind of like, if you think like Dave Lang meets like street bucket drummer, is the best way that I can think of it. So I'm using like 3 amplified books and, some tuned pipes and like a bass drum practice pad, for like a kick thud and then some cymbals and stuff. So it's all amplified. It ends up sounding, it's a really unique sound. And I think any player who plays it can kind of pick their own setup. So it'll be different interpretations, but yeah, that's happening tomorrow along with some other stuff.
Very cool.
Well, Dave, I have a question totally unrelated. Dave and I both went to University of North Texas for different degrees. I did my undergrad and you did your DMA there. Is that right?
Right.
Uh-huh. And we were talking a little bit about Christopher Dean before the podcast started, and I think Mr. Dean is sort of the unsung hero of the percussion department at UNT and doesn't quite get enough praise for all that he does. So Dave, I like to ask people, like, could you tell us about your studies with Christopher Dean and sort of what you got out of them overall?
Well, yeah, I mean, honestly, he was, besides the whole thing of North Texas, which is this really diverse, broad thing, he was one of the big reasons I went there. He was my major advisor. He was kind of my major professor the whole time I was there. So really one of the best teachers I've ever had. He's completely brilliant. Doesn't matter the instrument. You know, I think a lot of people would know him as timpani guy or tambourine guy or vibraphone guy, but it doesn't really matter what instrument you're playing. It could be a multi-percussion piece or a marimba solo or an ensemble piece. And I think he just has such a good ear and such a good sense of what needs to happen with whatever you're doing, and a way of guiding you within that. He's just also like endlessly investing in the students and putting in extra time. He's just kind of a model educator, and I hold him up as a man, if I could ever do what he's doing in terms of a teacher, because he's just a brilliant, brilliant professor.
Yeah. On that note, you were talking about it. It really doesn't matter with the instrument. I remember one time when I was there, the indoor bass drum line was rehearsing, and Mr. Dean happened to be around. And he would be the first person to tell you if there's anything out of his area of expertise. I mean, marching percussion is nowhere near his radar. But yeah, he was helping him out with it and talking about, you know, the intensity of their expression and all this stuff. And it was like Christopher Dean taking a marching bass drum line. How about that?
Yeah, I'd put him up against a lot of people who do it on the regs. You know, I mean, he's a seriously incredible educator. So he just hears really well, and he knows what to say. And he's just a really thoughtful and educated human, you know.
Yeah, and I remember for me, one of the biggest lessons I ever learned in all of music, which was from Mr. Dean, is that I thought when I was 18 years old that my, you know, sort of beautiful idea of musical expression would carry me as far as I needed to go. And he was the one to sort of inform me as a young musician that, no, you actually have to be able to play your instrument well, too.
Yeah.
the exact quote I remember from him was, they want machines out there, not artists. And this is coming from a very, very artistic person. So, yeah, I definitely, just like you, got quite a bit out of Mr. Dean.
Yeah, I could have studied with him endlessly. I think it, you know, so yeah, I hope
lessons always ran up to the very last minute, and then it was like, oh shoot, we're out of time. And I remember I had one lesson with him over the summer that was about 2.5 hours, and that was the only lesson I felt like I actually got everything in with him.
Right.
Have you guys ever played The Process of Invention?
I've started to play it and then stopped. It's involved.
I have not.
There's not a ton of marimba solos that are on my radar that are kind of older pieces like that. I mean, relatively. But like that's definitely on my hit list of something that I'd like to play. I had a DMA student do it here. I think it was 2 years ago. And that piece is wild and awesome. But it's also super exposed and incredibly tonal. So it's like, you know.
Yeah. I helped actually one of Christopher Dean's master students, who's now DMA here. Kai Polan's been on the podcast a couple times, and he does the whole thing with two mallets.
Oh, wow. That's wild.
Yeah. It's really cool. So that's up on YouTube if anyone wants to see it. Kai doing it with two. It's really, yeah, he did a great job.
I think it was Jason Baker's episode. We talked in depth about his pieces. I've played two of them. I think I've played Mourning Dove Sonnet, which I think most people probably know. But the other one I've played is A Robe of Orange Flame, which I'm thinking about pulling out again next year. And if anyone's unfamiliar, it's a 30-minute long thundersheet solo. It's just you and a thundersheet on stage for 30 minutes. It's with narration, so it's not just tapping on this piece of metal. But it's one of the, it's about the Buddhist monk that self-immolated in protest of the Vietnam War. And it's one of the most profound, just amazing pieces that just completely changed me as a player. That's definitely one to check out.
Yeah, and I'd say that, you know, as a composer, the diversity of his pieces are remarkable, and a lot of them aren't published or are lesser known than some of the greatest hits of Vespertine Formations, Mourning Dove, things like that. But they're all, I mean, they're all really brilliantly crafted and very specific, and they kind of have a very clear focus, and they're all very different from each other.
Yeah, has anyone heard The Bones of Changzhou?
No, but you've talked about it before, or maybe it was on Yijin Fang's episode, because she plays it, right?
Yeah, and it was written for Yijin. They share the same birthday, and it was a birthday present he gave her. But yeah, I mean, I don't think he would write a piece if he didn't have anything to say. Every single piece has something to say. It's kind of like Katarzyna Mieszko remarked about Anna Ignatowicz. Every piece has a message, and it's just so profound. And I think if he didn't have anything to say, he wouldn't write anything. But I think also he has quite a few things to say, so.
Yeah. Megan, so there was some recent sad news, and you were going to tell us a little update on Bernard Arwoma.
Yeah, so this week, 2 days ago, on Friday, April 27th, we lost a wonderful percussionist from our community. His name's Bernard Woma. He's a master of the Ghanaian xylophone, the djil, and he was an incredible player, an incredible educator, and had just an intense amount of energy. I've actually had him kind of on our list of people that we were trying to get for the podcast in the past few months that I've been working with him. And so I'm so bummed that we didn't get an interview with him before he passed away. So I would like to just talk a little bit about him right now. He was born in Ghana, and actually, as he came out of his mother's womb, his hands were clenched. We don't do video on the podcast now, so you can't really see this, but his hands were kind of clenched together, and that is a sign that you are meant to be a xylophone player. So his parents knew this, and so they got him a couple of xylophones, and he started playing djil when he was just 2 years old, which is absolutely incredible. And in Ghana, he studied quite a bit in Ghana. But then when he decided to come to the States, he went to SUNY Fredonia and he earned a bachelor's degree in international studies with minors in history and arts administration. And that's from SUNY Fredonia. And that was in 2008. And then he went over to Indiana and earned two master's degrees in African studies and folklore and ethnomusicology, and that was in 2012 and 2015. So pretty incredible that he had a fully sustained career in Ghana, working with the Ghana National Dance Company, and that he still decided to come to the United States and pursue more degrees. So I think that he thought that he could further his reach by having these degrees and by also having a community in the United States. I think he kind of bridged those two communities by creating a center called the Dagara Music Center. And he formed this in 1999. And this is how I first found out about him. I visited his center in 2007. And I was blown away by not only the accommodations at the center, there they have performance spaces and they have places for students who are studying to stay, and they have outdoor like dance spaces and class spaces. It's incredible. You can study dancing, you can study drumming, you can study djil playing. You can also study other things like crafts, like basket weaving and batik dyeing and language classes. It's just really anything that you want to know about Ghanaian culture. And Bernard is from the Dagara region, which is in the northwest portion of Ghana. And even though that's where he is from and that's the music that he has mastered, through his center, he seeks to perform and teach music from all over Ghana. So also different ethnic regions, which I think is pretty incredible that his dancers and musicians are fluent in these musical traditions as well. And so when they go on tour, they're able to portray a much larger picture of music in Ghana rather than just one region, which I think is pretty amazing. But this Dagara Music Center is a fully functioning music center for people from all over the world to come visit. And they host groups of students and groups of faculty members from universities, different nationalities, and different disciplines and fields as well. And they engage in a wide range of social, cultural, and educational services that are focused on building the individual's potential for self-development. And so this is not only to foreigners, but also Ghanaians. So very active in their community there as well. Bernard has performed all over the world. He's performed with Maya Angelou, Yo-Yo Ma, Glenn Velez. He's also performed for international dignitaries and presidents of the United States, such as Bill Clinton, Nelson Mandela, and Queen Elizabeth II. And in 2009, when President Barack Obama visited Ghana, he was honored as the cultural resource person for his visit. So he is definitely nationally recognized within the country of Ghana, and he's kind of deemed a true cultural treasure. But his reach is definitely international. There have been so many people since 1999, when the DMC was founded, who have gone to study there. And that's represented on the walls of the DMC. Whenever a university or a group goes to study, you get to paint your school on the walls of the DMC. And so if you just look up their website, you can see a beautiful collage of all these different universities from the United States and all around the world. It's really, really, really beautiful. And since he passed away on Friday, there have been many Facebook posts and posts on their website about his far reach as a musician and a teacher. It's been really touching. And Mr. Woma was touring all the way up until he died. He was in Eastern Kentucky when he passed away, and he was in Missouri less than two weeks ago from today. So he was with us at the Day of Percussion, which Dave was with us as well. And he also did a full residency at the University of Missouri. He had his Sakumu dance troupe with him, and we had a wonderful time with him. So he was working all the way up until the time that he died. And I think it's amazing, his work ethic and his passion for sharing this art form is evident in the fact that he worked all the way up until, you know, until he couldn't anymore. I think we all have a lot to learn from that. And he's a really, really, really amazing. So that's Bernard Woma, and we will all miss him greatly. If you are interested in studying at the DMC, everything is fully functional, and that center will continue to function. His family members run it, and he has teachers that he has trained throughout his years, and it will go on, and we will carry on his legacy now that he has passed away. So I encourage you all to check it out and go study there if you have the opportunity. And also, I guess most pressing now is raising money to send his body back to Ghana so he can have a proper
right
in Ghana. In are an amazing spectacle. There is dancing and drumming, and it's a 24-hour celebration and many rituals and traditions that go along with it. And people travel from a far distance. And with Bernard being the person that he was in Ghana, it's going to be a huge deal. So the next step is raising enough money to send his body back so that they can start to prepare for the funeral. So if you're interested in helping out with that, I'm going to post something on my Facebook page, but there it's pretty easy to find on the Dagara Music Center website as well, I believe. So
wow, thanks so much, Megan.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah, just a amazing report, and it's so cool that you got to know him personally, you know.
Yeah
and even sorry, go ahead. I was just gonna say, so that was just, I guess, 2 weeks ago, right, at Missouri Day of Percussion, two weeks from this past Saturday. Yeah. So from my perspective, never having interacted with him and seeing him give a clinic and a performance, and it was, you know, from my end of things, so high energy, and he was really charismatic as a clinician, you know, really teaching to not just the percussionists or older percussionists, but really to anyone who's in the audience, I think, could get something from that clinic. You know, and really moving and playing, and it seemed to be no loss of energy. So that just, it was really kind of took my breath away that he passed away, because that just didn't seem possible, given how lively he was just a couple weeks ago.
It reminds me of, on Emil Richards' episode, someone asked, you know, how's Emil, 80 plus years old, and like, how are you still doing this? And I don't think Emil really had an answer, and I sort of answered for him, and I said, like, it's just it's your life, it's what you do, you can't stop this, just, you know. I think that's Bernard sounds like another great example of someone that just, this is what he lived to do. And if he couldn't do it, I don't think he would want to be alive. So it's wonderful that he got to do it all the way up till the end.
Yeah.
Well, it's a sign of why someone like that is doing it. You know, if you've played for Nelson Mandela and Queen Elizabeth II and Barack Obama, do you really need to go to University of Missouri to give a little thing? No, of course you don't need to, but he chose to, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, and he kept choosing to do that. It's that's really says something about the drive behind success, you know, and the caring about the art first and not the, you know, the esteem. Or I mean, it's just so many good things to take away from that, you know.
Yeah, and also I think something that kind of held him up towards the end, and this isn't even towards the end, but for the past 10 years or the past 9 years, he has been touring annually with the Sakumu dance troupe, and they also are from Ghana, live in Ghana, are from various regions in Ghana, but they're a professional dance troupe, essentially, and they come to tour in the United States every year, and, you know, it's difficult to take a group of that size on the road, and especially when you're performing traditional music and doing it for educational purposes, especially too, you know, and not necessarily going with big presenting series and things like this. It's hard to have that many people on the road, and it's not always the easiest life. So they were dedicated to do that for 11 different tours, I guess over 10 years. This was their 10th year and 11th tour. So that was pretty amazing. When they were here, you could see that his energy kind of was held up by all of these people that were with him and that had studied with him and that travel with him and perform with him on a regular basis. And, you know, I think I'm sure that they could see him starting to fall, and they were holding him up as long as they possibly could. So I think seeing their energy and talent and effort along with that was really beautiful too, that he chose to do that. So.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, yeah, thanks, Megan. Really nice. Yeah, Ben, I think we've got some Facebook questions there. Would you fire one to Dave?
Yeah, sure. So we have a question, Dave, from Hannah Gallimore, and she says, given that you are a prolific composer, educator, and performer, how do you manage these three disciplines throughout the year? Does it change as the year progresses, or have you found a consistent balance?
Well, that's a great question, Hannah, and I'm actually going to see her tomorrow. She's a student at Truman State. I think about that all the time. We just had Tom Bird as a guest artist, I guess it was a couple months ago. And, you know, he's a guy who's, you know, a few more years into his career than me, but has been so successful. And so whenever I have a guest artist like that, I'm always asking them, I think I asked you this, Megan, as well, just like, how do you do it? How do you manage everything? I think before you even answer that question, it's, as I'm watching Casey go get Robin here, the thing that comes into play before I even get to those three categories is balancing, work and life, or I guess not work and life, but, family, because I really do, like, I think about percussion all the time. I think about my job all the time in a way that feels normal. I just daydream a lot about drums. And so, but at the same time, you know, I have three kids now. All of a sudden, I have a 4-year-old and then 2-year-old twins, and my wife, who's incredibly important to me. So first, I have to think about that and how to just, like, how much actual time do I have in a day, in a month, in a year to devote to those three things that Hannah asked about. And then from there, it's like I start divvying it up, and I just know enough about myself, I think, to know when that's out of whack. And probably the family thing is, like, a little bit. At least how much time I'm there is a little bit out of whack than I'd like to, and I'm constantly trying to rectify that. But in terms of those other three things, I definitely am trying to figure it out. I'm constantly trying to refine it. I'm trying to figure out how to devote the right amount of time to those. If I just look at my load as a professor at Nebraska, it's 60-30-10, teaching, creative and research activity, and 10% service. So, you know, I'm definitely spending a lot of time teaching, but I'm sure, like all three of you, that I'm just not a good teacher if I'm not doing something, if I'm not practicing, if I'm not regularly learning, and not just practicing stuff that I know already, but regularly learning something new and kind of challenging myself and pushing myself. And I definitely consider myself a percussionist first and then a composer second. And I've also kind of realized, Casey, I don't know how you do this, but I've definitely realized that I'm not good at, like, doing both at once. If I'm going to write for 2 weeks and I just don't practice and then I have to play somewhere, I'm not going to play well. Like, it's just not going to go really well. And if I'm supposed to be writing, I can't just do it for like 30 minutes after my practice session and have it work out. So what I've tended to do is, first of all, take fewer commissions and fewer projects and really start doing things that I absolutely want to do and are really important to me. And I do most of the writing in the summer. And I used to do a lot of, like, marching percussion arranging, basically since 2007. And, oh, look at that kitty. Who is that? It's one of your seven
babies and cats. Yeah. This is really a family podcast.
I used to do, like, a lot of marching percussion arranging since, like, 2007. And this is the first summer that I'm not doing that at all. And that was good, you know, to make some extra cash. And I really did enjoy doing it. And I'm fast at that. I'm a fast arranger and slow composer. So that would kind of get me going, but then it would be like mid July and I'd be like, oh, I got this piece that's due in like a month. And I'd kind of be in the routine of writing, but I hadn't actually started the thing I needed to. So anyway, I'm trying to reserve, you know, the summer for just practicing, learning music for next year, letting my mind wander a little bit. And then, doing whatever writing I have to do. And then during the year, it's mostly practicing, and a lot of it was a ton of performances this year. So I was just constantly kind of pushing to get ready for this and that. And then teaching, I really want to be available for my students and don't want to be an absent professor. So I'm focused on those things during the year.
I had a follow-up question to that, actually. Time out, by the way. Casey, this might be a dumb question. We might not get a good answer, so feel free to edit this out. Anyway,
okay.
I have a follow-up question about that. A while back, we had Mark Bozeman on, and he talked about his technical studies that he did as a student, and I guess still as a professional. And he said that when things that he, you know, technical things he was working on, when they got easy, that was a sign sort of that he had mastered them and had to increase the difficulty level somehow. And for me, I practice a lot of two mallet scales, and I won't go into, but basically I've found ways to make scales difficult for myself again. So is this something that you find yourself doing in your practice? And if you, like, maybe if you could share an example of that.
Well, yeah, I absolutely feel like I need to make myself feel like a baby constantly. Like, I don't know what's going on. And I think as long as the longer you play, the more you start to be like, well, okay, I can learn this piece quickly. And so pretty much every year at Nebraska, I do a faculty recital that has nothing to do with my music. And it's just new pieces that I've learned. Sometimes they're brand new pieces, commissions. Sometimes they're like greatest hits pieces that I'm sort of chipping away at. So for me, it's usually in repertoire. Like I like playing around. When I practice scales, it's kind of in a, like an improvisation context. I do a lot of that and try to, find things that aren't comfortable. I just like to make sure that I'm paying attention and I'm sufficiently stretched. But usually I try to do that, Ben, with like repertoire and just learning new pieces. So I kind of have multiple levels of playing throughout the year, pieces that are mine or that I've been playing for a while that I have to go play. Like tomorrow, I'm playing a kind of a mix of those and new pieces. Or like this recital I did at Nebraska last semester, I did all of Andy Kehoe's Ligneous with our Kiara String Quartet, who are also resident faculty. So it's like 40 minutes of marimba and string quartet music. And then I'd always wanted to play XY by Michael Gordon. So I did that one on that recital. And that piece is wild. Have you guys played that one? Are you familiar with that piece?
I haven't, but we actually talked about that a couple weeks ago.
Yeah, with Doug.
Doug, yeah.
Doug Perkins. Perkins.
It's just like, oh yeah, he's got a good recording on the internet. Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, it's just like one of those heavy pieces, like, you know, anything that Steve Schick has played or premiered, basically, it's like, if you can just kind of work your way through those in the next 50 years, you'll have played a lot of cool rep. So that piece, you know, that made me feel like a baby because it's like every polyrhythm and it's, you know, 6/5 in groups of two and groups of four and the sixes and groups of four and the fives and then groups of two. And so it's just like implied polyrhythms on top of 6/5. And then your hands crescendo in and out of each other. So you're constantly like having to keep track of the composite rhythm, but then also focus on the individual voices. And you should be able to hear both of those things, you know? So like I got obsessed with that piece last summer learning it and I'm playing it tomorrow as well. And then I'm actually trying to memorize it over the summer and I'm recording it with Evan Chapman or with 410 Media at the end of the summer. So and I'm also playing Con Variations tomorrow. I listened to your guys' Vignau episode, which was awesome. And yeah, like when I learned that piece a few years ago, that was one of those pieces that like, I was like, okay, this like feels really good in the hands, but like you definitely, there's some vocabulary, rhythmic vocabulary. And I think I'm pretty good at rhythms. I'm like a drum set player and I've been doing the rhythms for a long time. And this piece, I was like, I don't know, with the rhythms, there's so many rhythms. So that piece kind of made me feel like a baby for a second too. And then just kind of becomes normal.
Good, that's a pretty good way to sum up Alejandro Vignau's works is I thought I was pretty good at rhythm.
Yeah, I used to be good at rhythms. Dave Hall, 2006 or whatever.
They've redefined rhythm, these composers.
I would say that. So like, I like to play a lot of pieces by non-percussionist composers and people who kind of stretch the instrument or do things that I think are interesting. And then I kind of have another cycle of rep that are pieces that I can get up within a couple of days again and play somewhere. And then like chamber rep too, like new pieces of chamber rep. I just did a recital with a cellist, Greg Beaver, also of the Kiara String Quartet. We did that a couple months ago where we had like 3 days to put together a 30-minute trio, vibraphone, piano, and cello, and some other literature too. So, yeah, like that, I think learning new rep is the way that I kind of keep myself. I'm not even sure if I'm still answering the question.
Yes,
you are.
So, anyway.
Well, that's really inspiring to me. And so if you guys don't know, I have gotten to spend some time with Dave this year, which has been awesome. He was our guest at the Missouri Day of Percussion 2 weeks ago. And then I went up to Nebraska about a month ago, I guess, or something.
Which was awesome. Sorry to interrupt, but she was so great. Megan, she's awesome. She gave incredible clinics.
He has amazing students. So I think it's very inspiring to hear someone say, okay, yeah, you know, I'm doing all these things and I've got all these things to balance and all the plates are spinning, but I love that they're spinning and I, you know, I'm motivated when they're spinning and I want to keep them spinning. And so I admire you for doing all of that and doing it with a smile and doing it really well. And I guess that's just a segue to ask about one of your most recent projects, which is the Nebraska Steel Band. Can you tell us how that came about and how your first concert went?
Yeah, so we just premiered it. We ended up calling it Nebraska Steel, which I think is pretty sweet. And if you Google that now, you're not going to see like Calypso stuff. You're going to see like, you know, steel mills and stuff and like Midwest Steel or something like that. But anyway, we premiered a steel band. It was just this past Tuesday. And it was just the perfect time for it. And I really like contemporary classical music. I play a lot of jazz and a lot of drum set, and I love like playing orchestrally. But for me, you know, ethnomusicology was my minor and my doctorate. And it's just a big part of the way I teach to, you know, and it's not like Trinidad is that far away culturally or musically. But it's just a big part of the way I teach to think globally and to look at other cultures in a lot of different ways. So, this is kind of the first step. You know, we really focused at Nebraska on the like chamber playing. We got to play at PASIC in 2016, solo playing and large ensemble playing. I started teaching drum set there, which is kind of a new thing. And now it's sort of like, I want to get the world's, hey, what did I say?
I said Dave's strengths do not include geography because Trinidad is pretty far from Nebraska, actually.
I'm super disoriented. I'm in Missouri right now, which is not where I live, and I'm assuming that's closer to Trinidad. I'm assuming we're getting pretty close, at least.
Ben's ruthless. Ben doesn't let anything slide.
I drove like 5 hours, so I got to be closer to Trinidad by now. I'm assuming it's like
an hour flight from Columbia, Missouri to Trinidad.
Ben, you're going to get hired by CNN for being a hard, like, you don't let anything through.
He also did not say geographically. He said musically and culturally.
Thank you, Megan.
Ben.
So
no, this is good. Thanks, Ben. I was almost learning something, so I'm glad we got.
Glad I clarified. Music brings us all together. No one's far these anyway. Go on.
Yeah, and with the internet, message. You know. Anyway, so it's what was I saying? So we premiered the group this past Tuesday, and that's been like, you know, we just brought some Brazilian drums this year too. That's been kind of the next step for us is to start doing more of this. And, you know, I love playing pans. I play double seconds and lead, and I've been playing for a long time. Actually, when I was at North Texas, Ford went on a sabbatical for a semester. And so I got to direct the 2 o'clock steel band, which is, there's not like a 1 o'clock. That's the big one, the really good one. And that was just a blast. And those players there, you know, are outstanding and they can kind of learn anything, panorama charts or whatever. And, you know, that was just so cool to play in such a huge group and to get to teach it too. So I was just like itching to get this going. And our new director this year, sprung for some pans, and I think we're even gonna get a bunch more over the summer. So, and it was a perfect time too, because I had a bunch of students, undergrads and grads who play, you know, and kind of knew how to do it already, including this guy who's a Brian Zader student. His name's Lewis Raymond Kolker. And he's originally from Austin. I don't know if you guys know McCallum High School, where Matt Ehlers teaches. Do you have school with Matt, Ben?
Yeah. And actually, when I was in the indoor drumline at North Texas, we played at McCallum High School. So, yeah, I know it well.
Yeah, so they have, like, this high school has, like, 3 steel bands, you know. And so I've had a couple students from this high school, and anyway, he's a master's student now, but he's brilliant. I mean, he's one of the best steel pan players in the U.S. And so to have him there to help start it as well. And I don't normally, like, I'll play with the graduate students sometimes, like, you know, I'll play some chamber music and stuff with them, but you know, I don't normally play in the percussion ensemble. I like to teach that and coach it, even though most of it's unconducted. I like to watch them play, but I definitely am playing in the steel band for the foreseeable future because I jumped in the other day and it was so fun. Made me so happy.
Yay.
We had a gig, like, and it's just one of those things that, like, as soon as people see it, they're like, what is that? I need that at my doorstep immediately. Play at my party.
Yeah.
And so we had a story in the like the university online publication. And like the next day we were booked at a baseball game, which we played at, I guess it was yesterday or 2 days ago. So yeah, just for things like that, like we could go play like Xenakis, you know, at like a tailgate, and people would be like, all right, you know, with the drums, I guess it's cool. But like, if you do this, it's one of those things that can really put a face on the broader percussion program, school of music, and everyone kind of gets it immediately.
Yeah.
We were talking with Andy Harnsberger a couple weeks ago, and he mentioned that our mutual teacher, Don Bick, said, you never know what gig you'll take or something like that. In other words, as a student, it's important to be diverse. And we have a steel band here at Tarleton, and it's small and not that big of a, and not that, what's the word I'm looking for? Not that big of a group, so I can say, not that big of a deal. But part of the reason I was able to get this job is because I had steel pan experience, and I probably shouldn't say this out loud, but I'm not very good at steel pans. I never was. But just the fact
that cat's out of the bag.
Don't hire me, anyone listening. But just the fact that I had some experience on it was valuable and allowed me to get this gig. And we just had our concert, and Casey's student Caleb actually arranged Phil Collins In the Air Tonight for steel band.
Yes.
And we had this amazing operatic baritone on the faculty, and somehow I convinced him to sing Phil Collins with us, and it was pretty.
That's amazing.
I had I took the original drum track and made a loop of it. And I figured out how to put in like all the echoes and all that sort of stuff that was in the song. It was good stuff. So thanks, sweet. Caleb.
Nice.
Very cool. Very cool. I was going to add one thing to Hannah's question, actually. Let's see. Yeah. So just a few minutes ago, if you remember, Hannah Gallimore was asking from Facebook just about time management, basically. And it seems like you do, Dave, that does so much. And Megan mentioned, there's a lot of plates spinning in the air, but it's fun having all those things happening. And it seems like we are all kind of doing that a lot. And a student of mine recently saw me practicing late or something, or getting ready for a podcast, or just, you know, just being busy. And she said, like, is it always like this? I feel like I'm working so hard right now as a student, and I'm working so hard to manage all these plates spinning in the air. And then I see you professors, and like, you guys are still doing it. It gets better, right? And so it's true, we're all doing this, but I guess I just want to say to students, because they tend to ask that a lot. Like, we've had many students on the podcast ask specifically about time management. And part of me is like, put two dots together now, wondering if Hannah's asking also, does it like get better later, you know? And so I don't know, I guess I would contribute that. It's certainly, you know, if you want to, you can choose to keep many plates spinning. Or like Dave said earlier, he said he's more selective about the projects he picks and the gigs he takes, and he has the luxury of doing that now. So I think it's cool. And I would just add to say, both to my student again and to Hannah, that I think you do get much more of a choice, and a lot of us just choose to stay busy because, like Bernard Woma, Megan said at the very beginning, you know, it's just you just love this work, and eventually it is your life, and it's what you want to do. So yeah, there is definitely some relaxation at the end of all this work if you choose to take it. And I think we all do take it when we choose to.
Yeah. And especially if you need it, and if you learn that you learn when you need it and how you need it and how much of it you need. I mean, that's, I think, part of the struggle too, is like figuring out what you need and knowing, because no one can tell you that. No one can tell you that. You're the only person that knows that. But I was listening to one of our early episodes. I think it was one, actually we didn't have a guest. We were just taking Facebook questions, and someone had asked, how did you choose, I guess it was, how did you choose which grad schools to go to? And we were all talking about how it was the teacher. So maybe it wasn't this question, but it led to the conversation of, well, none of us chose the schools that we went to because they thought that they would get us jobs or like the programs. It was not that. It was all, the artistry, it was all, oh, I want to study with this teacher because I really admire how they play or what they do, or, you know, I really enjoyed working them with them when I did. And I think we all sort of said, you know, no, I mean, and this is obvious, but we, none of us went into this for the money. None of this went into it because we thought it would be easy. We all went into it because we love playing music. And I think that's the bottom line, is that you have to continue to love music. And for most of us now, also, that includes a lot of teaching. And so figuring out how to stay passionate about those things, I think, is really important.
Mm, yeah, well said.
And I think that a lot of it for an undergrad student is that it's new. This, I mean, when I was in high school, I went to school and I would practice a little bit when I got home. But I mean, 8 o'clock at night, I was done playing video games or, you know, doing nothing basically on AIM, which isn't around anymore.
You didn't play video games.
I did when I was in high school. I don't anymore. I grew up.
Let's play some Halo.
I didn't play Halo. I was a Nintendo person. Not important right now.
We should get you back into it.
I was also a Nintendo person.
But I think, like when you get to college and, you know, the idea of going to the practice room at 10 o'clock at night and practicing until midnight when they kick you out is, that's a novel concept, especially because our work is so physical and standing up and moving around. But I think, yeah, like we've kind of talked about, you learn to find a balance. And at the end of the day, I can't complain about working late when what I'm doing is music. It's not like I'm sitting at a desk, doing someone else's taxes or something.
Yeah. So I will say, like, I think the big difference, between being an undergrad and now is I definitely remember times in high school or undergrad sort of like walking into a practice room or being during a certain part of my day and thinking, oh, what should I work on now? Like, what should I? And I never think that. I always have like this endless list, and I can pick like a category of my life, like in teaching or like, you know, like the ever present, like administrative work or practicing this piece or that piece or this piece or that piece, or like, you know, there's score study for a percussion ensemble. There's so many things that you can pick. So, and then usually I'm kind of like excited to get to do that. So I do this all the time. You know, I have a normal practice session in the morning, and then like after the kids are asleep, I'll practice again. And I'll go, sometimes I go back to school if I'm playing like really loud drums, or a lot of times if I'm just playing marimba, I stay at my house where I have one. And, that to me is like bonus time. That's like, this is awesome. I get to practice and it's uninterrupted, and usually no one's there. So no one can come in and be like, hey, Dr. Hall, how's it going? Want to get coffee? You know, which I love too, but it's just like kind of that uninterrupted time. So, and yeah, then Casey was alluding to this, just being more selective. So like everything that I'm doing essentially, and I'm continuing to kind of cull away things that I don't find as much benefit from, but I'm always trying to pick like the exact things that I want to do. I've seen like 7 different cats walk by Megan.
You might be a cat lady.
There's a clown car of cats emptying out in front of Megan.
It was the same cat.
Different outfit. Same cat, different outfit.
She's like pleading with us. She's like, no, please, I'm not a cat lady. It was the same cat.
I know.
She kept going back and forth. And then did you see a girl on this table and she like made a different appearance? It's the same cat.
I found out that Megan's a cat lady, which I wouldn't have pegged her for. But
I guess. Yeah. Yeah.
It's only been in the last year.
I know.
Lady before. I'm a cat lady. Sorry, continue.
Oh, so yeah, I don't know if I had a whole lot more to say other than that. Yeah, there's just always something to do. And then in the summer, like I'll ride my bike up to campus, which is pretty far away, and I'll ride all the way up there. I'll practice for a while, and then I'll kind of clock out a little bit early, try to spend more time with the kids, make some food. And, you know, then that feels a little bit more relaxed, and everything I'm doing is based on just like practicing that I want to do. And then I allow my brain to wander a little bit more and not to be so strict and regimented with things. So I don't know. There's a balance. And yeah, like Megan was saying, I like when I was 30, I got this job when I was 29, and I turned 30 right after that. And then we had our first kid. And then I swear my body like broke into pieces, like immediately after that. And I'd like finished my DMA. I got the job that I wanted. We had a kid and I was like, things are great. And I was still waking up at like 6 a.m. and practicing and, you know, playing every one of my students' lessons and then staying after school and, you know, till really late. And then my body was like, this is awful. We're going to break now. And so then I felt really bad and I had to cancel my first recital. And I just had to learn how to like stretch and sleep more than like 3 or 4 hours And, yeah. you know, just so I would say, yeah, well, on, to kind of sum up from my end, Hannah's question, apart from those three categories, which I'm always trying to keep in good balance, you know, health and family and just, you know, just like I know that I work best when I'm in a good mood, and I know how to manage that. And I have to, you know, I don't like a lot of highs and lows in my temperament. So I don't think students do either. I don't think they like to know who they're going to get when they show up. You know, is this going to be angry Casey or happy Ben or super pissed off Megan? Like it's kind of helpful if they know what they're going to get. So, yeah, I just try to make sure that like mental health and physical health are also, you know, I'm taking care of those things, but it's really difficult. I think it takes a lot of work.
I think one good way of summing this up is there's this sign that I read on the wall at Jimmy John's every single time I go. And it says, if you do the work you need to do when you need to do it, then one day you can do the work you want to do when you want to do it. And
Why is that at Jimmy John's?
I don't know. They have all these like dumb quotes around. Don't eat at Jimmy John's, by the way. The guy is like super terrible and goes trophy hunting in Africa. But options are limited. And Stephen.
What? I was just going to ask, what's your sandwich?
But number 12 on wheat at Dijon. But anyway, I think that's a great way of summing it up is like when you're an undergrad, you're going to feel swamped, but one day you'll be swamped, but at least doing what you want to do.
See, but that guy from Jimmy John's, like he did all the sandwich making crap and now he can go kill animals and because I guess that's what he's into.
Yeah, maybe if you follow that advice, you end up killing endangered animals and I don't like it.
I'm going
to
go.
You make the sandwiches when you don't want to make them, then eventually you can do horrible things to the environment.
Yeah,
what a great lesson. That out,
Ben. Ben, thanks, I think you Ben. Should publicly redact that.
You're just going to cut it out probably anyway.
No, yeah, probably not. What about, man, this is great. Thanks so much, Hannah. That was a lot of good substance there. Hey, how about another Facebook question? Anyone got them handy?
Sure, I've got them handy here. So, Parker David Stockford asks, what's a good way to get in contact or meet with professors at prospective schools when you're in a very far state to travel from? I go to school in Hawaii, and it's almost impossible to go meet with professors before an audition. What is a good way to meet them?
Well, first of all, I'd be curious to know where Parker goes to school. I taught just a couple years ago in Honolulu at Kamehameha High School. And anyway, I'd love to go back, so maybe I'll see him eventually. I would say, yeah, obviously, if you're looking at schools and you want to make a lot of visits and you're coming from Hawaii, that's, which I'm pretty sure is close to Trinidad. I'm just kidding. earlier joke, if you're just tuning in.
Next door, actually.
I'd say the best way to go about it is to go to PASIC because you're going to see a lot of people there and a lot of clinics. And I mean, that place is amazing. You can learn so much and you can run into a lot of people. I meet with a lot, I'm sure all three of you do as well. I meet with a lot of prospective students at PASIC, undergrad and graduate, and have coffee and just kind of like hang out and get to know each other if they can't make the trip all the way to Lincoln for a lesson or whatever. So that's a good chance to meet multiple people. But and I'm always, you know, if anyone does make it to Lincoln, I'm always happy to give a free lesson to a student who's a prospective student. And I think that's a good thing to do on both ends. But yeah, I'd say go to PASIC. And if not, you know, we got the internet and you know, you have email and you can just reach out through the virtual realm and connect with people that way. I think that I really appreciate when I get a really nice, well thought out, like thorough email from a student, a prospective student that's addressed properly. And it just shows that they put some thought into it and maybe had like one of their friends or their parents read it or something. When I get one of those, I think it says a lot about a prospective student, that first impression, even if it's just an email impression.
Yeah, and I think on that note, it's not a bad thing if you're that remote in Hawaii or on some sort of military base outside of the U.S. or something like that. You can just explain, you know, if very well worded, I'm very interested in studying with you, but my, you know, current situation doesn't allow me to come for a visit before I audition, and just go back and forth and maybe you can set up a Skype lesson or something.
Or even just a Skype conversation, you know, or something quick. I feel like there's so many online resources now. I mean, there's so many. You could look at just our podcast alone and get a flavor for, I mean, we've had, yeah, well over, we're at 143 right now, but I think people's personalities really do come out, especially, you know, the course of an hour And yeah, there's enough sources like that out there. There's, of course, our podcast. There's Pete's Percussion Podcast. There's this one called Discussions in Percussion. And yeah, they have guests, and see if you can just, you know, narrow your focus on who you might want to write that email of, like, hey, can we set up a Skype chat? I live in Hawaii. Or, you know, also just really keep an eye on who comes to, say, yeah, University of Honolulu, or what guests are coming in, and then just visit them. It's worth being in Hawaii, though. Hawaii's great. That's don't worry.
Also, just I think any of us would go there at any time. So
yeah, well, that's what I was gonna say, is if your school has some sort of like day of percussion thing, which most do, and you know your professor is bringing in a guest artist, and you're interested in meeting Tom Burritt next year or something like that, suggest Tom Burritt as a guest artist.
Yeah.
Or all four of us.
Or me.
Yeah, or just this crowd right here. You know, my brother lives in Hawaii.
How sweet.
Yeah, it's pretty rad. Yeah. Well, let's see. We have, Ben, do the tattoo question.
So we have one more question, also from Parker David Stockford. He says, what are the opinions on tattoos on performers? Should they be covered? Are there certain situations where they don't need to be? Are there certain genres of music where they're more acceptable than others?
I'm excited about this question. I saw it on the interwebs a couple days ago.
When this question was asked, we all were like, "Does Dave have like a full sleeve tattoo or something we don't know about?" And he actually showed us every part of his body. He does not have any tattoos.
Yikes.
We're audio
TMI.
Only, so you can't see, but that did happen.
Yep, you guys missed the fun.
You've been thinking about it for the past 5 hours on your drive.
So full disclosure, I don't have any tattoos, and I'm sort of a minimalist, so I think really hard before I like hang something on the wall or like buy a new shirt. So the thought from my perspective, like in my own opinion, that doesn't apply to anyone else, like the thought of like permanently marking something and then having to look at it, because I would want to change it. I would want to be like, maybe not this, you know. Like I said, I have pictures that are like in my office that I've thought about hanging for like 8 months. And I will eventually, but I just like, I'm like, oh, but I like the wall all clean like that. So like tattoos are kind of the same way for me. However, I have tons of students who have tattoos. I don't really care or have an opinion, you know, as long as it's not some like huge vulgarity or like racist thing. That's like, you know, like no swastikas maybe. I think like we, you know, when we played at Capesic a couple years ago, and I don't really care if my students like roll up their sleeves or whatever, they don't all need to look the certain way. And there's a bunch of pictures of the students with like tattoos, and I think that's kind of badass. Actually, I like that. So, I guess I don't have a huge opinion on it for other people.
I mean, I think in the music world in general, things are progressive enough that people care a whole lot more about who you are as a player rather than, and to a certain extent, who you are as a person. But meaning, like, are you a good person? Not whether you're male, female, gay, straight, black, white, whatever that sort of thing. The only thing I have to add to this topic is that if you do get a tattoo, for me, it's more of like just the financial thing. It's like my students are constantly saying, you know, oh, I'm so broke, I don't have any money and all this sort of thing, and it's hard to pay rent. And if you're getting a tattoo and it costs $75 or something, that's not going to break the bank, but you better be able to afford all your supplies for lessons or something like that.
Mm-hmm. That's like half a tambourine.
Well, depending on the tattoo.
Yeah.
It's a PAS membership.
Yeah. Megan, what do you think about tattoos?
I'm the same. I mean, it doesn't really bother me either way. I have one tattoo.
Like face tattoos, but...
Yeah. I mean, but like people can do what they want. And I mean, I think that this topic is also kind of like about clothing maybe as well, just like the way you present yourself in general. Mm-hmm. I think it's a good conversation too, because you know, we look at the orchestra and everyone dresses super super conservatively because, and you know, you're, or just professional orchestras in general, I guess, right? Like you're for the, at least, and maybe as men you don't think about this as much because it's like you wear a suit or you wear blah, 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 whatever. With women, you kind of have to be like, well, wait, can I, what if it's sleeveless? Like, is that okay? And I don't know. I feel like there are more guidelines, especially in the orchestra. And I think like in percussion ensemble, you know, sometimes, or even in wind ensemble and things like this, you know, I guess, okay, sorry, I'm just going to cut to the chase. One time there was a donor that said something to me about what one of my students was wearing. And I was like really conflicted about what I should do with that. And I ended up not saying anything because to that student, because he or she can do whatever they want, you know? Yeah. And like, I will give guidelines in studio class or whatever, I guess, like that's my time to give advice. But unless, and I guess it's the same as tattoos, unless it's like super racist or something, as long as it's not offending anyone else, they mm-hmm. should be free to express themselves. At CalArts, they have the orchestra dress as colorfully and sparkly as possible.
Uh-huh.
I think that is so cool, you know, because yeah. it's like you're all sitting on stage together and like be yourself, like be different. Don't blend into whatever, because that's, it's almost like, you know, if the classical music and the orchestra, as you know, we talk about this on the podcast a lot, but just as the way it is in the traditional model, if that is not sustainable in the United States, or at least with as many orchestras as we have, maybe we need to do something different. So like blacking out all of the performers, is that really what we want to do? I don't know.
Right. It, that reminds me of something Mike Vercelli said. He's the world percussion teacher at the University of West Virginia. He's
also
he's
a student of Bernard's.
Yeah. Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
Oh, he's, man. Well, anyway, there was, I was there for something and the students were dressed in their pit black for percussion ensemble or for something. And he just made this, you know, funny comment like, man, everyone in black, it's a, yeah, you guys bummed out to be performing or what, you know? It's like, yeah, it's so I know, yeah, I can totally see that. But then I can also see like, well, you know, sometimes you're playing pieces where you want to be invisible, you know, you want to be as blended as possible. And yeah, I can see both. Yeah. My answer to, oh, sorry, Megan.
Oh yeah. No, that makes sense. I mean, if it's like for a specific reason, for sure. But I was just thinking like for that donor and my student, you know, I was like, okay, I don't think what he or she was wearing was incredibly offensive. And so I'm not going to say something just because someone with money, you know, is like, that offended me.
Right.
I don't know.
That example that you brought up, the donor saying something, it made me think, and I guess my advice to Parker is that, yeah, you're talking to, or you're hearing from four people in their 30s, and yeah, we're sort of, yeah, tattoos are so common in our lifetime. It hasn't been something that, you know, we've been taught means, you know, any specific thing. And of course, in the arts, yeah, they are in fact artistic. People in the arts are, yeah, it's very common to see them. So I guess the thing I would just add is it's sort of like the question of, do I address this person as Mr., Mrs., Doctor, Professor? And yeah, you kind of, I think if you're, you know, approaching someone of an older generation, you may just, you know, maybe just do the safe thing, or even younger generation, I would say, you know, you're approaching, anyway, maybe just do the safe thing first and say, excuse me, Mr. Charles, Dr. Charles, Professor Charles, and then feel it out from there. So yeah, sure. If you're going on a job interview and you don't know who might be interviewing you, you don't know what they think about tattoos. Yeah. You just cover them. Yeah, and get like a cool dragon with like a dagger in it.
Absolutely.
Yeah, like a skull with a knife. That'd be sweet.
Eating a dragon.
Yeah.
You can just get one of those like fake tattoo sleeves one day, Casey, and walk in and see what your students say.
That'd be sweet. No, that'd be really cool.
What
I really
do you think
want
they'd
some
do?
Tattoos, actually. Yeah, my sister is totally sleeved. She's a math professor.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, my sister Amanda, she's sleeved. So she's like right there all the way up both arms.
Wow.
Down her back. Yeah. Well, you guys, this was really, really fun. Dave Hall, thanks so much. It's great to finally chat with you.
Yeah.
Thank you guys so much for having me. It was really
good. Of course.
Thanks very much, Megan and Ben and Laurel. Good luck there in Chicago with your reading session, University of Chicago. And yeah, great. We'll catch you guys at 1:44.
Bye.
Bye.
Perfect.